This is an island surrounded by water.
Yes, as is the case with most islands, Mr. President.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
He's very smart.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Knows all the best words.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. On Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Palinville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on 102.3 WHIV. Washington, D.C.'s 105.5. And AM 950 KTNF in Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe every day on islands or not, over the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. I suppose I should add the caveat, there is one island we may not be heard on right now, and that is the island of Puerto Rico, where the power is still out across much of the island. Internet is a rarity at best. We will be talking about that situation in a moment. But first, this just breaking before airtime. Donald Trump promised he would hire only the very best people, Desi Doyen,
yes,
to be in his administration. You remember that promise, right?
I remember that promise.
Well, another one of those very best people, another big one, late on Friday, has now been forced to resign in scandal, shame, and disgrace again. Someone's going to have to do a study to see if there has ever been this many resignations and firings so soon in any presidential administration. I can't imagine that there has been. It's been well over a dozen at this point. I think we're about 20 or so. And this administration is barely, 8 months old now. Among those who have quit or been fired before Friday, Trump's national security advisor, his press secretary, several different communications directors, his chief strategist, his acting attorney general, his FBI director, all in that very short time. Well, now this, Tom Price, the Health and Human Services secretary, resigned under pressure on Friday, says the New York Times here, as who I'm cribbing from, after racking up at least $400,000 in travel bills for chartered flights and undermining President Trump's promise to drain the swamp of a corrupt and entitled capital. By the way, that $400,000, that is way lowballing it. Get to that in a moment. Already in trouble, says the Times, with Mr. Trump for months of unsuccessful efforts to repeal and replace President Barack Obama's health care program, Price failed to defuse the president's anger over his high-priced travel by agreeing to pay a portion of the cost and expressing regret for his actions. In a statement, the White House said that Price offered his resignation early today and the president accepted. Price's resignation came barely an hour after Trump had publicly dressed him down yet again for the second time in a week, because that's what Donald Trump does with the best people that he hires, and said that he had that he would decide whether or not to fire the secretary by the end of the day. "I'm not happy, okay?" the president told reporters before boarding a helicopter before heading off to his New Jersey golf club for the weekend.
Hmm.
Price's job was on the line ever since the first of a string of reports by Politico, who did a great job on this starting around mid-September, concerning the extensive use of charter aircraft by Secretary Price in a bid to assuage Trump. The secretary offered on Thursday to reimburse the government, but only for about $52,000 of the $400,000 that were spent on these private chartered aircraft, which he had said, Price had said, would pay for the cost of his own seat on those trips. That didn't cover the money spent by taxpayers to fly Price's entire entourage on these pricey airplanes, often to major cities where commercial flights were already available for a percentage of the cost. And that $400,000 is dramatically lowballing it. Politico has since reported that Price also took expensive military jets for overseas trips to the tune of about $500,000. So that's about $1 million total spent by Dr. Price. Yes, he is actually a medical doctor. So how's that swamp draining going, Mr. President? Of course, recall that Price is a self-declared fiscal conservative as well. This is just one of the reasons why I always put quotes around the word conservative when I refer to these guys. Nothing actually conservative about them. He has been leading the fight to cut government spending for everybody else, including trying to cut trillions of dollars from federal spending on health care, trying to gut the Affordable Care Act. So Price has been in office 261 days. NBC News reports that makes him the shortest ever serving Health and Human Services Secretary, going all the way back to 1939. And he is not the only member of the cabinet to come under fire right now for using private jets for government travel. We could see more of this, more such firings or resignations, whatever you want to call them. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who I know, Desi Doyen, you are a huge fan of, he is also under fire right now for spending about $50,000 on similar private chartered flights. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was using...
Who is a billionaire, by the
who
way.
Who is a billionaire, but he...
He charges the taxpayers for his flights, though. Doesn't
well,
miss a trick.
Well, when he's going, right, when he's going to look at the gold in Kentucky... And at the eclipse with his for his honeymoon with his new bride. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, also I know another you are another fan of his, Desi Doyen. He has also chartered jets on the taxpayer's dime since the Trump administration began. So we will see what happens in the days ahead with some of those other officials who have been doing something similar. As we spent some time reporting after Price's nomination back when he was still a congressman from Georgia, he was already known to be about as corrupt as they come. He had led the U.S. House Health Committee as chair, and he sponsored a whole bunch of laws that would affect medical and insurance companies at the very same time that he was investing and buying stocks in those very same companies, often in sweetheart deals offered to him by these companies, you know, whose bottom lines would be impacted by that legislation. Nonetheless, despite the fairly obvious corruption and pretty blatant conflicts of interest, Republicans in the U.S. Senate apparently had no problem at all with Tom Price. They confirmed his nomination pretty much without hesitation. Meanwhile, Republicans in that same U.S. Senate continue to do the very same thing when it comes to Donald Trump's judicial nominees. Those are for lifetime tenures on the federal bench, and the ability to affect the interpretation of the rule of law and the U.S. Constitution itself, those decisions affect the nation for decades. They're just waving all of those federal nominees right through at this point, no matter how crazy or corrupt their records show them to be. They don't care. They are not watchdogs in the U.S. Senate. We'll be joined momentarily by our friend Mark Joseph Stern, legal reporter at Slate.com, to discuss what he describes as a new plan to, yes, lay the groundwork to overturn marriage equality. Yeah, really. And we'll also discuss a high school principal who is now threatening to discipline students for taking a knee in peaceful protest during the national anthem. So do schools have the right to take away constitutional free speech from students? We'll discuss all of that and more with Mark Joseph Stern momentarily, and including, if we have time, the stolen Supreme Court, which is now back in session with a stolen Republican majority at the helm. Yes, elections do have consequences. In the meantime, speaking of consequences, the federal relief efforts to Puerto Rico, well over a week after Hurricane Maria, are, they're going very, very well, at least according to Donald Trump.
As far as Puerto Rico is concerned, we have had tremendous reviews. We're doing a great job. Everybody has said it's amazing the job that we've done in Puerto Rico. So I think we've done a really good job. We are going to do far more than anybody else would ever be able to do.
Totally. Doing a very good job. Very good job. No
more
one
than
disputes
anybody
it.
Else has ever done before.
That's right.
Or ever
could,
will
right?
do.
That's right. Well, in a series of tweets on Thursday night and Friday morning, Trump continued to tout his administration's response to the devastation in Puerto Rico after two hurricanes tore through the island, Hurricane Maria and what was the other one? That was Irma.
Yes.
I guess. And Trump continued to bash the media coverage of the federal government's recovery effort so far. Trump has claimed that the media has not been covering his administration's efforts fairly. And he boasted that Puerto Rico's governor told him that he was pleased with the federal government's response so far. Of course, officials like the Puerto Rican governor aren't idiots. They have figured out that telling Trump what he wants to hear, that he's personally doing a great job on this or that, that that's the only way that they stand a chance, frankly, of improving efforts from the government at this point at all to the ravaged island. We know more than enough now about Trump, I think, to know that telling him he's great is pretty much the only thing that he wants to hear. And he can only, you know, I can only imagine how he would respond if leaders like the governor of Puerto Rico at this point, which is currently in desperate need, if they were critical of this man-child president. Nonetheless, today, during remarks to a speech to a manufacturing trade group, Trump continued to blame Puerto Rico itself, to blame the island of 3.5 million U.S. citizens for their own problems, citing the island's distance from the U.S. mainland, among other reasons for the worsening humanitarian crisis.
This is an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water. We're closely coordinated with the territorial and local governments, which are totally and unfortunately unable to handle this catastrophic crisis on their own.
Yeah, they can't do it on their own, you know, the way most places do. I remember when Hurricane Harvey struck Houston. Houston totally handled it on their own.
Yeah.
Florida totally handled Hurricane Irma the week after that, totally on their own. And by the way, as far as the distance from the U.S., Puerto Rico is actually closer to the U.S. mainland than Washington, D.C. is to Mar-a-Lago. Just saying. And I think there's been quite a few flights from Washington, D.C. to Mar-a-Lago over the past few months. Nonetheless, the administration has come under fire for the way that federal officials have described the recovery efforts, given that nearly the entire island, as I said, is without power still. Residents there are struggling to get food. Half the island does not have potable water still. Yet Trump has consistently boasted about the administration's efforts. And on Thursday, his acting Homeland Security director, Elaine Duke, incredibly enough, actually described the situation in Puerto Rico as a good news story.
I am very satisfied. I know it's a hard storm to recover from, but the amount of progress that's been made, and I really would appreciate any support that we get. I know it is really a good news story.
Totally, totally nothing but a good news story for the people of Puerto Rico. The mayor of its capital city, San Juan, The mayor, Carmen Yulín Cruz, appeared on CNN on Friday. She had not yet heard those remarks by DHS Secretary Elaine Duke. FEMA, by the way, is run by the Department of Homeland Security. So after the after CNN played the comments for the mayor of San Juan, she seemed to be stunned. And she frankly blasted those comments from the Department of Homeland Security secretary.
Well, maybe from where she's standing, it's a good news story. When you're drinking from a creek, it's not a good news story. When you don't have food for a baby, it's not a good news story. When you have to pull people down from their buildings, because, you know, that, I'm sorry, but that really upsets me and frustrates me. You know, I would ask her to come down here and visit the towns and then make a statement like that, which frankly, it is an irresponsible statement, and it contrasts with the statements of support that I have been getting since yesterday when I got that call from the White House. This is not a good news story. This is a people are dying story. This is a life or death story. There's a truckload of stuff that cannot be taken to people's story. This is a story of a devastation that continues to worsen because people are not getting food and water. If I could scream it a lot more louder, it is not a good news story when people are dying, when they don't have dialysis, when their generators aren't working and their oxygen isn't providing for them. Where is there good news here? I mean, the good news is that we're getting hurt. The good news is that there's boots on the ground. The good news is that the people from FEMA have their heart in the right place and the HHS people know what to do. For heaven's sake, somebody let them do their job. Let them get the food and the water in the hands of people. And then let's talk about good news. Really sorry. But you know, when you have people out there dying, literally, scraping for food, where is the good news?
That was San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz on Friday. She sounds just exhausted.
Yeah, they have such a long road ahead of them, and this is such a distraction for them to not be able to get what they need and having to fight and scream and yell just to get this minimum help.
Yeah, that she and
to clear out the red tape for them.
Yeah, that she and the governor have to keep going on TV to talk about this. There are apparently a lot of supplies sitting there in the ports, but there is no organization on the ground to take these supplies around and to get them, to distribute them where they need to be. Much of the island is still reportedly unreachable by aid workers due to the damaged infrastructure and the lack of organization on the ground by federal officials to move that aid that has arrived. And even to San Juan itself, a lot of those goods are sitting there in San Juan and not even getting to the people in San Juan. Just horrific stories are coming out of shortages of clean water, food, electricity. Even though this storm and the consequences in Puerto Rico is getting apparently far less coverage by the mainstream corporate media itself about this crisis in Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria than was seen after Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Hurricane Irma in Florida in the preceding week. So the media itself is dropping the ball there. We have had callers. We had a caller on the show, I think, on Thursday asking what they can do to help, what it is that they need down there. Well, we have been pointing folks towards UnitedForPuertoRico.com. That was set up by Governor Rosello's wife. But there are many aid organizations out there, and this effort is going to take a very long time before things stop getting worse and finally start getting better, no matter what distractions the President of the United States continues to throw at us here. And speaking of distractions, Mark Joseph Stern joins us next on the fallout from Trump's national anthem nonsense that has been going on amidst all of this. Even, by the way, as the groundwork is being laid to overturn marriage equality. Yes. Pay attention, people. This is the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Several days ago on the Bradcast right here, I interviewed Mikey Weinstein of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation on what seemed to be some pretty remarkable and blatant attacks on the U.S. Constitution's separation between church and state. Weinstein's group has filed a series of complaints with the Department of Defense, now said to be under investigation by the Air Force Inspector General, concerning a guy by the name of a chaplain, a U.S. Air Force Reserve chaplain named Captain Sonny Hernandez. In a recent article, for example, Hernandez in this piece headlined, "Christian service members avoid supporting or accommodating evil." In this article at a Christian website, Chaplain Hernandez, a chaplain who is supposed to minister non-denominationally to all members of the military, writes that, quote, "Christian service members who openly profess and support the rights of Muslims, Buddhists, and all other anti-Christian worldviews to practice their religions because the language in the Constitution permits are grossly in error and deceived." Hernandez went on to charge, literally in this piece, that such folks were tools of Satan and that counterfeit Christians in the armed forces will appeal to the Constitution and not Christ, which he writes will lead them to hell. Again, he's a military chaplain in the U.S. Armed Forces. Weinstein, the former White House legal counsel under Ronald Reagan, whose legal organization represents thousands of military member clients, that organization was originally formed during the George W. Bush era to push back against a wave of blatantly unconstitutional proselytizing in the U.S. Armed Forces during the Bush presidency. Mikey Weinstein kind of surprised me by arguing that while we're all distracted with whatever idiocy Donald Trump is tweeting about on any given day, that same problem in the U.S. military when it comes to Christian dominionism is now far worse than it was even under George W. Bush.
It's Katie bar the door, an unbridled magnitude of hate directed towards the other. Every night and every day and every way we see it more and more and more. It's being validated. But not just that, we saw it back in 2004, but nothing like the last 8 months.
Really? It's worse now than it even was under George W. Bush, as far as you're concerned?
Oh, I never thought I'd say this. So right now, you probably can't hear me because of the sounds of hell freezing over. I would take George W. Bush back in a heartbeat.
So that was Mikey Weinstein from the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. So to quote a Bush-era phrase, perhaps I have misunderstimated the return of the rise of the religious right under this president, under President Donald J. Trump, who, for his own part, seems anything but an evangelical Christian, much less a Christian anything, to be frank. So perhaps with that in mind, I should not have been as surprised and skeptical as I initially was when I saw the headline from Slate's legal reporter Mark Joseph Stern this past week, arguing that Trump is laying the groundwork to overturn marriage equality. Really? Seemed kind of clickbaity to me at the time when I first saw it, at least until I actually read the article. Mark writes, "Donald Trump's presidency will last at most for 8 years. His administration can do a great deal of damage in that time, but the judges he appoints to the federal judiciary will serve for the rest of their lives. And if history is a guide, some of Trump's hundreds of judges will still be serving in 2067. That gives them ample time, he says, to wreak all sorts of havoc on civil rights. Less than a year into this administration, it is clear that a key agenda item for Trump's judges is the rollback and eventual reversal of marriage equality." Seriously? Yes, apparently so, or at least as Mark Joseph Stern argues at Slate. So here to argue that case on the broadcast is Mark Joseph Stern. He covers the law, the court system, the Supreme Court, and LGBTQ issues, and much more for Slate.com. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thanks for having me back on. Always a pleasure to terrify you as best I can.
Oh, and you do so with consistency. Even though you had it easy a little bit over the summer, we haven't had you on a lot because the Supreme Court has been out of session. But those easy days are now over, my friend. I want to talk to you about your total clickbait headline there concerning Obergefell and maybe some other items as the stolen Supreme Court with the Republicans' stolen 5-4 majority comes back into session with illegitimate Justice Neil Gorsuch now on the bench in earnest for the first time. But first, listen, you cited a letter published on Thursday by Daily News reporter Sean King from a high school principal at Louisiana's Parkway High School that picks up on Donald Trump's ridiculous and ongoing attacks on NFL players for having the temerity to publicly exercise their First Amendment constitutional rights by kneeling during the national anthem. I want to ask you about this letter. Let me just read it. It's short. This is from Waylon Bates. He's the principal at Parkway High School, which in Louisiana. He writes, the Louisiana High School Athletic Association allows school principals to make decisions regarding student participation in the national anthem while competing in athletic contests and games. Parkway High School requires student athletes to stand in a respectful manner throughout the national anthem during any sport event in which their team is participating. Failure to comply will result in loss of playing time and or participation as directed by the head coach and the principal. Continued failure to comply with results will result in removal from the team. Parkway High is committed to creating a positive environment for sporting events that is free of disruption to the athletic contest or game. Well, we know that the Supreme Court has ruled over the years, Mark, that school officials have some leeway when it comes to limiting constitutional rights of students. You posed the question, however, in your piece on this letter at Slate, can public schools like Parkway constitutionally bar students from political expression in this manner? Well, can they? You have the floor, and I will go out for a sandwich while you take it.
Thank you. This is a sandwich-worthy screed I'm about to deliver.
I know.
This letter made my jaw drop to the floor because it appears to me that the principal who sent it has not only never read the Constitution or the First Amendment, but has apparently never even read any case law over the last 75 years expounding the principles of the First Amendment, because it has been established for a very, very long time that students do not lose their free speech rights at the schoolhouse gate, that public school administrators are bound by the Constitution when they limit student activity and expression, and that a school cannot compel any students on campus to display some form of patriotic expression, which is essentially what this principal is trying to do. And more than that, the case law is very clear that a school cannot prohibit a student from expressing themselves through some conduct that is not disruptive to the course of learning. It's really easy to resolve this case just by reading the First Amendment, but I think we should talk about specifically what's going on here to understand why this is a frontal assault on, again, 75 years of case law. During World War II, there was a huge blowback against Jehovah's Witness students at school for refusing to stand and pledge allegiance to the flag. There's a religious tenet in their religion that says you cannot pledge allegiance. It's some kind of sort of false prophet principle. Students refused to do it, and the Supreme Court first upheld that decision. and upheld schools' ability to prohibit these Jehovah's Witness students mm-hmm. from, you know, staying quiet, said, yes, these schools can force Jehovah's Witness students to stand and salute the flag. And this decision was so catastrophically wrong, so outwardly horrible and terribly reasoned from every perspective, that the court revisited it and dramatically reversed it just a few years later. And in 1943, the decision is called Barnett, mm-hmm. the Supreme Court said, absolutely freaking not. Schools cannot force students to show any kind of patriotism. Schools cannot bar students from acting on their own principles in school. And I'll read you the key line here. Mm-hmm. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. That line alone clearly resolves this case. Just like schools wanted to force Jehovah's Witnesses to stand and salute the flag in the 1940s, now schools want to force student athletes to stand and respect the national anthem instead of taking a knee. And the exact same principles that applied back then apply today. You just can't do that. Students have a fundamental free speech right to take a knee during the anthem. And if this principal goes any farther with this crazy campaign, he's going to get slapped with a lawsuit that is going to make his hair fall out, because they are going to lose the second they walk into a courtroom.
Well, I have two questions on that. One, you also write, you cite the that iconic opinion from Justice Robert Jackson that you just read from there, going back to 1943. But you also cite another case, Tinker versus Des Moines Independent Community School District in 1969, which apparently made exceptions for expression that, quote, materially disrupts classwork or, quote, involves substantial disorder or invasion of the rights of others. The principal here in this letter from Parkway, Louisiana, refers to the school being committed to sporting events that are free of disruption. Is there anything to his argument that these peaceful protests are in fact disruption that could be that could fall under that that disruption exception in the Tinker case in 1969?
No, there really isn't, and I think that's pretty obvious from the facts alone. You know, how in the world could a peaceful, silent protest, simply taking a knee during an anthem, disrupt school or learning in any way, or disrupt the game that is about to occur in this context? The argument against that would be...
I'll tell you, people start booing, they show up into protest, counter-protesters, protest the kneelers. Mind you, I'm not arguing that they should not be able to do this, but I could see the counter-protesters showing up. That leads to disruption, the game can't move forward, and at that point... Does the principal or the school have the right to say, oh, you're not allowed to do this because look at all the disruption it's causing, that even though we've caused it by our counter-protests?
Right. So in the law, that's what's called a heckler's veto. And as a general rule, the government cannot use the threat of a heckler's veto to shut down speech. The government can't typically say, we're so concerned about the adverse reaction to this speech that we're going to preemptively stop it. Mm. But we don't even have to get that far in the analysis to answer this question, because the Tinker test is very clear in focusing on the disruption caused by the speakers themselves, not the disruption caused by people who react to the speakers. So I'll give you an example straight from Tinker.
Yeah.
Tinker involved five students in the 1960s who wanted to protest the Vietnam War by wearing black armbands.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that this occurred, the Vietnam War was pretty popular in Des Moines, and actually there was a pretty negative reaction to these armbands. There wasn't violence, but a lot of students were very displeased with them. They said, you should be patriotic. You should be supporting our boys in uniform. Teachers were upset. It was kind of a radical act in the late 60s in Des Moines to wear a black armband protesting the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court said, you know what? We really don't care how flustered teachers or other students get. This is as peaceful as protest can be, literally just wearing a symbolic expression on your clothes. That is not disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And if other people react poorly to it, you know, that's on them. And it is the job of a school to maintain order in that kind of situation. You do not get to use the threat of other students reacting poorly to preemptively shut down expression in this way. So yes, I understand what the principal was getting at with this whole disruption idea, but it just doesn't pass the smirk test on any level.
Glad to hear it. And I want to get onto marriage equality here in a moment, but I have one more question on this. It's all well and good that the law and the Constitution would seem to be on the protester's side in this case. And by the way, I should add, I don't even know if there are any actual protesters at Parkway High School doing this, or if the principal is just, you know, putting out this warning preemptively. But what happens, Mark, when what would be the roadmap for a case like this where players are prevented from playing, potentially suspended from the team or even from school? I mean, obviously, a challenge to the Supreme Court like that takes a while, and those students would lose not only their constitutional rights, but also their ability to participate in school activities and potentially even the school itself while all of this is litigated. No, I mean, what do they do in the meantime about their rights that have been taken away? Their rights as students and as Americans have been taken away. Is that just the way these things go?
No, it shouldn't be in this case, because the First Amendment, in addition to guaranteeing free speech, it also bars government retaliation against speech that the government doesn't like. And so if there are any players at this school who might want to kneel, who have read this letter mm-hmm. and are offended, perhaps this letter, you know, opened their eyes to some racial problems and violence against black people that taking a knee was all about,
mm-hmm.
and now they want to kneel, if they wish to do that, then they should probably just call the local ACLU office if they can. And their lawyers can file for an injunction in district court. Under, you know, the First Amendment argument mm-hmm. saying, look, you have to preemptively block this threat, you know, mm-hmm. to the judge. You have to block this threat from ever happening because this is a clear violation of the First mm-hmm. Amendment. And I suspect that with this letter alone, any judge, even one appointed by Trump, would probably immediately say, yes, you're absolutely correct. The judge would issue an injunction, a preliminary injunction, prohibiting the school or the principal from actually enforcing this policy. And if that doesn't happen, if no one goes to the court and tries to stop this before it occurs, and the school ends up having an opportunity to retaliate against students who do take a knee, those students will be able to sue not just for an injunction, but for monetary damages, because it is clearly established in the case law that students have a right to express dissent in this way. And because it is clearly established, these school administrators who are enforcing an unconstitutional policy are liable. They are liable under the law for their unconstitutional behavior, and these students could probably successfully sue the school for a pretty decent amount of money. So, you know, the school should proceed cautiously at this point, because it's not just a smackdown in court that they're looking at, but actual monetary damages for screwing up this badly.
Mark Joseph Stern, sit tight. I need to take a quick break here, and we will come back and discuss your piece on Trump laying the groundwork to overturn marriage equality. I think there's a lot of misunderestimating going on right now concerning this administration. So sit tight, Mark. We'll come back and we'll talk about that right after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, speaking with Mark Joseph Stern, legal reporter over at slate.com. Okay, Mark, so while there is what you describe as settled law when it comes to the issue of, you know, protesting, kneeling during football games at high schools like Parkway High, as we discussed in the last segment, I've got some concerns, and it seems that perhaps you do as well. When it comes to this new stolen Republican majority on the Supreme Court, now filled with some pretty radical right-wingers, I've got some concerns about them actually honoring settled law, which brings us to the story, which when I saw it, when I saw the headline, I was, in truth, really skeptical, at least until I read it. Trump is laying the groundwork to overturn marriage equality. Really? How so? And I'll go get another sandwich while you answer.
Well, I mean, if you don't believe me, then I encourage you to read the words of one of Trump's latest judicial nominees for a district court in Texas. District courts being sort of on the ground enforcing federal law. And in fact, if there were a situation like we just discussed going on in Texas, students would go to this judge's courtroom if he is confirmed. They have a lot of power, these district court judges. People don't care much about them, but they do. So Trump just nominated a guy named Jeff Mateer to serve on a district court in Texas. Let me tell you some things Jeff Mateer has said. He has called transgender school children part of Satan's plan. He has described same-sex marriage as disgusting debauchery. He has compared it to people marrying their pets. And he has endorsed ex-gay conversion therapy, which you and I and most listeners surely know is really just psychosexual torture. This guy may well serve on one federal court or another. He's starting at the district court level, but he might not stay there for the rest of his life, which could easily extend to 50 years. I believe he's in his 30s now. And so he will have an opportunity as a sort of gatekeeper to the federal judiciary, as a district court judge, to hear these cases that will surely arise in Texas around the edges of Obergefell. So obviously, Obergefell, the marriage equality decision, guaranteed a fundamental right to all same-sex couples that they could get married. But it actually did a lot more than that. The Obergefell decision is extraordinarily sweeping. And as we've discussed on this show before, the majority opinion says that same-sex couples deserve the entire constellation of benefits that a state grants to opposite-sex couples. So basically, any kind of benefit or privilege or right that a state grants to opposite-sex couples now has to be granted to same-sex couples on an equal plane. And that is a part of the decision that courts that are anti-gay, that are hostile to civil rights, have read out of it completely. We've already seen this happen in Arkansas, where the Arkansas Supreme Court said that same-sex parents didn't have a right to list their names on their child's birth certificate, even though opposite-sex parents can list both of their names on their child's birth certificate when that child is not their biological offspring. The Supreme Court of the United States had to reverse that decision. Of course, Neil Gorsuch dissented. And we've seen this in Texas, where the Texas Supreme Court, which is elected, of course, and all Republicans, said, you know what, we aren't sure that Obergefell guarantees same-sex couples the right to spousal benefits on equal footing of opposite-sex couples. We can think of plenty of reasons why same-sex couples don't deserve spousal benefits. Maybe the state has a legitimate interest in favoring biological offspring rather than adoptive children. This is actually something that a Texas Supreme Court justice wrote. So we see this kind of rebellion against the breadth of Obergefell in the lower courts. I think that if Mateer is confirmed, he will join that chorus And I think we all know that Neil Gorsuch is a willing collaborator, an eager collaborator with this group of judges who are trying to push back Obergefell as much as they can. Imagine that just one or two of the more progressive justices steps down during Trump's term. That would leave the door wide open for the court to begin allowing these decisions to stand. And the more decisions that they allow to stand that push back on gay rights, the more vulnerable Obergefell itself becomes. Lawyers like to call this stealth overruling. You don't take on Obergefell directly. You don't try to say, yes, courts can just deny marriage licenses to same-sex couples, but you nibble around the edges. You say, well, maybe not with birth certificates, maybe not with spousal benefits, or adoption, or surrogacy, or health care, or stuff like that. And then you have so many rulings that undercut Obergefell that the Supreme Court, stacked with Trump people, finally feels comfortable reversing Obergefell entirely. This is, I think, a chillingly plausible scenario for us. I absolutely believe that it could happen, and I think that we are not paying nearly enough attention to the threat because it is already here, and it is only going to get worse.
And we're talking about hundreds of federal judges that Donald Trump is likely to appoint. He's already nominated. Throughout his term, even if he makes the even if he's removed in 4 years or less, all of these judges are simply moving through, these federal judges who will have lifetime appointments on the bench. How much are Democrats themselves to blame here for doing away when Harry Reid was the majority leader, doing away with the Senate filibuster to block judicial nominees? Because as far as I know, have the Republicans rejected any of these far-right nominees? You named just one, but there are tons of them that you detail in your story. Have any of them been rejected? And how much are the Democrats to blame here for allowing these to go through without, with just a bare Republican majority?
No, none of them have been rejected so far. And that includes John K. Bush, who's been now appointed to the Sixth Circuit, who was literally an anti-gay blogger who used the word faggot in a public speech not long ago. Republicans found this guy fit to serve in the federal judiciary, voted him through unanimously. They've also, the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republicans on that committee, have also voted through a guy who says that anti-bullying laws are bad because they promote gayness in schools. I don't think that there's really a line of decency that these people are willing to draw. And so I think that unless Democrats can take the Senate in 2018, we're going to see 4 years and hundreds of judges pass through with really little public outcry. Now, your other question, that's a little bit trickier because, of course, you know, Democrats were in a real bind in 2013 when Harry Reid nuked the filibuster. They had these very, very qualified nominees, and Republicans simply refused to budge on them. And so I think that it's very understandable what Reid did. And in fact, I strongly suspect that if he had not nuked the filibuster in 2013, that Mitch McConnell probably would have nuked it for lower court judges in 2016 or, I suppose, 2017. That is the more likely route to me. So I don't really blame McConnell. I think he did what the base demanded and what he felt he had to do. And because of his actions, Democratic appointees now hold a majority of seats on several very influential circuit courts, including the D.C. Circuit, the second most important court in the country. So I wouldn't lay this at the feet of Harry Reid. I would lay it at the feet more broadly of a Democratic Party that is unwilling to deal as ruthlessly with the judiciary as Republicans are. They're just playing a different game. Republicans are completely ruthless in their endeavor to stack the courts with wackadoodles. And until Democrats learn some lessons, I think there are some positive lessons to be learned about rallying your base around the importance of the judiciary, then this problem is just going to keep going on and getting worse and worse.
It is, and there's no real good remedy for it because, as you say, these people will be on the courts throughout the country now for for decades, frankly.
Yeah, that's right. I recently had a conversation with Judge Damon Keith on the Sixth Circuit. Mm-hmm. He was first appointed to the federal judiciary by LBJ in 1967. So, as I said in my piece, you know, I think it's absolutely plausible. In fact, I think it's pretty inevitable that in 2067, we will be living with Trump judges still. Jesus. That is a long damn time. Yeah. And Democrats need to get their act together, or the world is going to be incredibly bleak in 2067, so bleak that Trump judges may be the least of our problems.
Jesus. One more just quick thought on this, Mark. A commenter on your article about Obergefell already being under attack in the courts says Trump is laying the groundwork. Trump is not laying the groundwork for anything, at least not intentionally. I think that's a fair point. To be fair, does Trump even himself know that he is doing this? He has pretty much outsourced the appointment of judges entirely to the Federalist Society, to the Heritage Foundation. I don't know if it's fair to say that he's laying the groundwork to overturn marriage equality, because I don't even know if he realizes that, although that may be a distinction without a difference at this point.
Right. I think that commenter made a really good point. I don't mean to give Trump any credit here. He is rubber stamping these nominees. He's an important part of the process, but like I explained in the article, he's really farmed this out. He's farmed out the appointment of many, many, many important positions to these outside groups like the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. They are the ones who have groomed these guys for decades, mm-hmm. Preparing them for this moment, and they are the ones who are compiling the lists that Trump is now just sort of rubber stamping and getting these guys in the judiciary. So you're right that it's ridiculous to pretend that Trump knows what he's doing, but he doesn't have a problem with just letting other groups do it. So yes, he's asleep at the switch, but the train is hurtling toward the same cliff no matter what.
As I noted, I suspect we're going to talk a lot more in the near future, Mark Joseph Stern, now that the Supreme Court is coming back into session. Already some troubling stuff going on there that we don't have time to get into today. But I want to get very quickly, before I let you go, Mark, your thoughts on, well, who I and I think you describe as illegitimate Justice Neil Gorsuch palling around in Kentucky with Mitch McConnell last week, the guy who stole his seat for him, and then over the past week, speaking at the Trump Hotel, Neil Gorsuch was, the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. this week, as the court comes back into sessions. Very quickly, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's obviously awful. And I think specifically what's so disgusting about it is not that it clearly violates a specific ethical code. You know, the Supreme Court is not actually bound by any ethical code. The justices pretend to follow it, and they mostly do. But if they transgress ethics, nothing actually happens to them. Mm-hmm.
Unlike the federal, I mean, there's actually rules for the district courts and the appellate courts that do not apply to the Supreme Court, correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
These exact rules that apply to the lower court judges, the justices say they follow them, but again, because there are no consequences when they don't, I don't think that they adhere to the letter of the law the way that lower court judges do. But what's important here, I think, is that the spirit of the ethical code is very, very clear, that judges should do their absolute best to maintain the appearance of impartiality. And that is an important phrase, because what we see here is Neil Gorsuch, I think, basically trolling his political opponents. Hmm. He's giving a speech to this group at Trump Hotel that helped to finance a challenge to public sector unions that the court just accepted, and this term Gorsuch will almost certainly provide the fifth vote to kneecap public sector unions. And here he is, chumming it up with them at a luncheon at Trump Hotel. And there he is, over in Kentucky, with Mitch McConnell, the two best buds who, you know, enabled each other's current positions. It's really disgusting to see, and it shows that Gorsuch just doesn't care about his illegitimacy problem. Yep. He really doesn't care that so many people view him as sitting in a stolen seat. He's not going to do anything to try to maintain the appearance of impartiality. And in fact, he's going to do the opposite. He's going to stick his thumb in our eye with his lack of impartiality. He's going to mock us with his actions, showing us just how little he cares about looking like a truly impartial judge.
Yep.
This is not like speaking before the Federalist Society, speaking before the ACLU, or even a group that litigates, reproductive rights. This is something very different. This is about money and political power alone. He is showing that he has all the power in the world. He's got it, and he doesn't care what anybody says about him. If he's illegitimate or in a stolen seat, doesn't matter, because he can cast that fifth vote when it counts, and that's all he cares about.
He's not even pretending. You're right. You could pretend for a year that, hey, I'm not going to speak out, I'm not going to do this or that. The fact that he's not even pretending to be impartial here is not a good sign as we start this new Supreme Court session. Mark Joseph Stern, I'll point people over to, as usual, over to slate.com to read your piece about Trump laying the groundwork to overturn marriage equality, about that Parkway High School case or issue. It's not yet a case, but may soon be. And more of your thoughts on Gorsuch and all that you do. Mark Joseph Stern, we will talk to you soon. Folks can find you at slate.com and on the Twitters at MJS_DC. Thanks as ever for joining us, Mark. Buckle up.
I am all buckled in and ready for takeoff.
Thank you, brother. We'll talk to you soon. All right, I got to get out. My thanks also to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us today. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, please download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. You can also drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks and the Twitters. I am simply The Brad Blog. And my thanks, as ever, to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to become an active supporter, to help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves. Whether we do it well or not, I can't tell you, but we try our damnedest,
we
don't
do
we?
We do try.
All right, that is it for now. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.